Now, I found your artwork to be especially effective. I typically do not like abstract art, and when I sent you the first email, I
said
that.
You said that.
Well, I think I don't remember. I think I used the word despise. I typically despise a lot of.
You have a strong language.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was in the shape of a compliment. I think it was like a run-on sentence in the same breath, saying that yours is an exception, and when it works, it really, really, really
mm-hmm.
works.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, see, I'm already flattering you from the beginning. But I don't mind doing that. I think the biggest problem that I see with a lot of the abstract work that I see in galleries is that it seems as though they're being belligerent. They seem to be just throwing stuff at a canvas and seeing what sticks without
mm-hmm.
any determinable means as to what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And afterward are willing to bullshit. We've had two or three episodes on art, starting
mm-hmm.
with the episode What is Art?
Mm-hmm.
And then another one basically like What is Art all over again. And I was pretty much the only one out of the four on both occasions that was pretty adamant on there being a standard of quality. Not to say that it should be, you know, mathematically judged or that there's a scorecard that
uh-huh.
needs to be supplied. But there needs to be some sort of common visage of understanding as to what is crap. We have to be able to look at a work of art and say it's bad. And the only thing, I guess, that the reason I would say I am so adamant about, you know, railing against a lot of the abstract art that I see
mm-hmm.
is that it seems disingenuous. And it seems as though they're relying on the ambiguity
mm-hmm.
more than they're trying to give you some sort of, I don't know, not oral, like A-U-R-L,
mm-hmm.
A-U-R-A-L, that they're trying to give you an emotion and whatnot. But I think that they're taking their chances a little too much. So I guess what I'm getting into after a minute and 46 seconds of me running my mouth... what is your approach? How much of it is from beginning to end? How clear is the idea of what you want at the beginning?
Well, even with a specific concept to start out, say, for example, if somebody's asked for a commission piece, and I really have to try and aim for something that they've seen or that they've talked about that they're going to find satisfying. Even when that happens, or maybe it is when that happens, it's the most obvious that in spite of whatever I start out with the intent of, how it plays out is what makes the magic, when I can just let the paint speak.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it being commissioned is in itself an overall theme, or at least
well,
there are guidelines.
Commission's it's a strange little creature that a lot of artists find repulsive. You know, when I first started painting, I know a lot of people said, well, you can't do that, you know, you're selling out, prostituting yourself. And I was very happy to be able to remind them that most of the greatest artists in history had patrons, and they had to paint what the patrons wanted.
Goya, Michelangelo.
Absolutely. John Singer Sargent hated painting portraits, and that
Diego Rivera
didn't want to do this, but it was like, this is either worked for the royal family, the church, or some other very, very rich entity, and did what they wanted.
The Rockefellers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the Medicis didn't, I mean, I'm sure they dictated some to what was going to happen. And the whole nature of art to begin with, I mean, by that I mean in the earliest post cave scratchings, but when it became something that was an undertaking that went on all the time. It was an actual like endeavor to be an artisan or an artist. They all served some purpose, whether it was to decorate the queen with her jewelry, I'm thinking Egypt or something.
To paint a flattering portrait of royalty.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the notion that a commission is a bad thing went right out the window, and plus it gives you an opportunity to paint. That's all.
Yeah, and really, I guess, relating to the reason that I'm so offended by something that's a smattering, a Pollock ripoff, or something
mm-hmm.
that's just thrown together, mm-hmm. is that it doesn't seem as though they are they're not communicating. It is not a community effort. It's almost something that is made for them personally, or they're the only one that can personally glean anything from
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are a commissioned artist, you are, in fact, contributing to your society. If you were to do a mural in a library,
absolutely.
It's art, even though you are expected to follow a certain theme. You can't, you know, put an upside-down cross and a bunch of demons barking at mad dogs. You can't do whatever the hell you please. You can't be your true self. But at the same time, you can express yourself as an artisan, as a skilled artist, as opposed to just relying entirely on your own vision. It's a contribution to society, and it's a communication. And that maybe that's why. And I personally, your artwork personally communicates to me. I find it. I don't have any trouble being struck by it. And that is something. And so when abstract art works for me, it is a really big deal. And that's why I regret so much that most of it is such crap. But
well,
I mean,
and to me, that's one of the biggest compliments is when someone isn't particularly an aficionado of abstract work. Probably my biggest moments in real life, you know, when people have come up to me at a show or something and talk to me, the thing that's been the most fun is when it's a little kid, somebody's child, because they're so non-judgmental. They're just responding.
Yeah, they're not acting on precedent.
No,
they're not trying to cover their asses.
No, they're just responding. And the other one is when I have had men, and particularly men who are scientists, like engineers or mathematicians, when I have that kind of collector or party who comes up to me and says, oh my God, you know, I really love this, or I'm respond to this. And I'm perfectly happy with the notion that there doesn't have to be a real verbal explanation as to why somebody likes a particular piece of art. I think, especially with abstract work, it just works.
Well, yeah, I would say that with a lot of abstract art still on the subject, of course, that there is, I think a lot of abstract artists like to deal in emotion, where I think that you do that in your own right, but there's also an intelligence to it. And maybe that's what the big turn-on is for me, is on top of the fact that it is expressing some kind of, that it's expressing a feeling, which, okay, fine, so many things express a feeling, but to have a determinable message, and the fact that you're good at titling your work, which...
thank you.
Well...
To me, that's such an integral part of it. I always, when I see these things, untitled.
Yeah,
and please.
Come on. I mean, you can
cop
do
out.
It is a cop out. It's like, I mean, because I mean, a title really gives a context to the work that you've done, and even if you made it after the piece itself, you're still kind of giving the audience an idea of what is behind all of this.
Well, I certainly do. I know artists who title things kind of on an emotional level. They want them to be about love or a sunset or.
Passion number 5?
Yes, something like that. Whereas I actually use the titles to, sometimes I'm being sarcastic, sometimes I'm being tongue-in-cheek, sometimes I'm simply kind of relating my place in the world at that moment. A lot of my titles have really tell a story about where my life is at that particular point. And I mean, I could literally sit with you and go through the titles and say, oh, well, I can tell you why that one's called that. And I mean, I've done little stabs at people by name, you know, calling a title a certain thing.
What, like Loaded with Money or Aggressively Stupid?
Aggressively Stupid was absolutely aimed. I had a few pieces in a show one time that were kind of all about the politics of what was going on in that gallery at that time, which was...
Did they know it? Could they tell?
No.
Good. That's even better.
It was. Now, some people got it, which made it all the more fun. But even in years past, I have done shows where I've taken all the titles of the paintings and woven them into a poem. And I enjoy doing that just as an exercise in creativity.
Were the paintings a series?
Yes.
Okay.
So the show, part of it's fun because... It's the one time that all those paintings are going to be in one room at the same time. They're going to all go to different places, different homes, if you will. And so for that one month, or what usually it shows up about a month, but for that moment, all these pieces of work are in one place. They are all, I used to even get it, I was so neurotic about it, I would even hang them. I would make sure I had the floor plan for the gallery, and I would hang them so you could read the poem as you went around the room. And some people, I actually got somewhere I would print it right on the note on the invitation announcement card, so you could walk in, go through this poem, and walk around the room and see the work. And some people over the years got it. You know, they would come to an opening and see this and see the poem on the invitation, and comment and really enjoy that aspect of it. Other people, never phases them.
Yeah, see, but that's...
Title doesn't mean anything, and I don't really care. It's just, I do that for to
satisfy myself.
But
all they would
need
in order to get it would be intuition. They would only need that. It's not that they, oh, well, you just don't get it because your heart's not in the right place.
No, your
heart doesn't, just your mind
no,
has to be in
exactly.
the right place.
Exactly. And when I say somebody didn't get it, it's that doesn't mean that I'm putting them down. That's just not why they were, that wasn't part of what they put into looking at art.
Oh.
They just came in and looked at the pictures, if you will, and the titles meant nothing. And I think that's why a lot of artists don't even feel like they want to bother with titles, is because it doesn't, to them, it doesn't contribute to the finished piece. To me, this is part of the process of creating this, is to give it a name and a title, and then I have a lot of fun with the titles.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of galleries that I've been to lately, especially, I've bitched about it a lot, is the untitled pieces, and then when they make something, they title it quite literally, because they're going to give it a worded title. So if it's a wrought iron elephant, they're going to call it elephant, or, you know, elephant one, or great big elephant, or the worst of all, and in certain galleries I've gone to, is puns, which at mm-hmm. the same time they're trying to deliver humor, and when they're making a piece that doesn't necessarily have to be humorous, I don't know if they really had humor in mind. I could name examples, but I'll be fair. And, you know, and that's an important thing to me personally, is when somebody does have a gift for words as well as of images,
mm-hmm.
because I think that the both go hand in hand so very much.
Well, I do too, and thanks for noticing that, because, again, for me, that has to be a component of the finished piece, is what it is. One time I did a commission, and it was going to be shipped back east. I lived in Santa Fe at the time, and it was coming up to shipping date, and I still didn't have the damn thing named. So finally, I just called it Remains to Be Seen. I don't know what to call it.
did they like that?
Oh, they loved it.
That's really deep.
They loved it, yeah.
For improvisation, you can't help.
I definitely try to keep a sense of humor about it. But it's also a good way, the titles are a fun way to tell a little more about myself, I think, than I might have to in a painting, but... The titles are all very meaningful to
me. And it's communication.
And yes.
It takes away from ambiguity. And it isn't relying so much upon, you know, giving... I mean, it's not relying so much upon the artist. It's actually giving a little bit of that responsibility or that
mm-hmm.
capability to the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, of course, when I was talking about bullshitting, a lot of times when somebody makes a piece of abstract art and they really... They'll be judgmental of people that don't approve of it because it doesn't make any sense, and they'll say, oh, well, you just don't understand it. And of course, the common problem is that the person that made it doesn't understand it either.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can really skate by a lot on that. You can get away with murder.
For sure. But I've never been offended or put out by people who just don't respond. I don't care. I'm not on a crusade.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to convert anybody.
What kind of criticisms have you gotten, other than the fact that it doesn't match anything in their house?
Some people don't like the shine. They don't like that surface. They feel that it's looks too artificial. Like, I once heard these ladies in Santa Fe at a gallery say, I was told this story, that one said to the other one, well, it looks like Mop and Glow.
Damn. Well, that would have been her whole review, too.
That was it. It looks like Mop and Glow. You know, I had a bad review in Dallas years ago. A young lady by the name of Christina Reese, who has since then opened her own gallery here in Dallas, wrote a review that was so ambivalent, because she started out about how she had always come to my shows and she loved my work and she wished she could buy one. And then she got really concerned because there were too many red dots, which meant the stuff was selling. And if it was selling that quickly, there had to be something wrong.
You're a sellout. You awful sellout.
I know.
How dare you?
You lowlife.
Well, you sell well, though, don't you?
You
I mean,
well, I do commercially, yes, I do well. And I got to tell you, if I didn't do well, if I couldn't make a living at this, I don't know that I would be one of those artists that has to that just like is going to fill a warehouse with paintings that nobody wanted. I like to do it as an endeavor to make a living.
Yeah.
And so I get up in the morning and I treat it. This is my job.
Yeah.
This is what I do. And I do it every day, and I do it Now, I don't paint all day, but it's sort of, you can see, I live in that environment. I don't like not having my studio at home. And I forgot where I was going with that.
Well, I don't like going anywhere without my pads. I have my pads on me. I'm not going to write anything while I'm here. I mean, I don't have the time, I don't have the inclination, but every time
there's
I don't have them, I need them.
Yeah, there's just something about, I've had studios where I had to get in the car and go. And the worst part of that was part of my process is to sit with my work in the evening, lights down, spotlights on them, just like they were in a gallery, and be able to kind of absorb them from that angle as opposed to from the work environment angle. And so if I have to sit there and then pull myself together and get in the car and drive home, I don't enjoy it as much, and I don't find that it's as productive. I like to be able to take my shower, have my dinner, wander in, sit with the painting, sip a glass of wine or a drink, and I'll actually sometimes make notes, little sticky notes, you know, so I have to do this or do this. Oh, yeah. And it's a lot of, I've always said to people, if you were standing outside my window and just watching me, there'd be a lot of time when you go, she's not doing anything. She's just sitting there. She's just staring.
How do these things even get made?
Yeah. But it's like, well, you'd be amazed. I may sit for an hour and stare and then get up and do 20 minutes of furious activity and then sit for another hour and stare and go back and scrape it all off. But I think that's perhaps why my work has a higher level of development, if you will. I feel in a lot of ways there's just character building in this process.
It's premeditation, mm-hmm. as opposed to spontaneity, you know, when I'm just going to flick a paintbrush at this
right.
to see what happens. And devil may care and come what may, and maybe it'll all just, maybe I'll be able to make a good enough excuse for myself by the time I'm selling it for $3,000.
Right.
We were talking about before we started recording, this was about an hour ago, about how you had talked about the writers, as somebody who is a writer of books, and you the ones that you've met or the ones that you've listened to in the past.
Just, you know, what their style of working is or what they need to accomplish their work.
Yeah.
I related to that far more than any other artists that I really could call out by name, because it involved, I know a lot of artists who really enjoy a lot of social time. They like to go to the coffee house and, you know, sit and visit with other artists and drink, you know, coffee and talk about art and debate and all this. And I really don't like to talk about art. I don't mind talking about the process of making art. Or the technical side, because I love the technical side, because it's kind of a scientist quality to it, or, you know, the research doctor or something. But when abstract in particular, it's too easy to do a few strokes, splatter a little paint, and you find yourself going, oh, there we go. But it's like, no, you know what? If it looks good after those first couple of strokes, you got to cover it up. I think it was Picasso who said, as soon as you get something you like, you have to destroy it and start over because it hasn't got enough to it yet and has to have more underneath it than just
what you just
that
couple
of strokes
together. Well, yeah, I mean, I look at as far as the technical aspects of a painting, and I usually would have compared it to if you go to visit somebody's house, and just to give a little context, you'll see a painting and you'll notice a spot where they made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see, you can just tell
mm-hmm.
from the look of it, the way it's painted over, the layering, mm-hmm. the thickness of it, you know that they tried to do something there, and they made a mistake. They screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sort of takes away from the whole thing, because you're like, you know, it gives you that feeling that there is a lack of predetermination or whatever.
Follow-through, yeah.
And you know what, I always likened it to whenever you'd go to visit some friend at a studio apartment, and you can tell where the hallway to the other end of it, it used to be a hotel room, for instance, and the hallway, you know, has been covered with a wall, and the breakfast nook was turned into the kitchen, and they used the bathroom, but they had to build another one on the other side, you know, and you could just see where the boards are incongruous, and... And where the wallpaper looks like it's from the 1970s, and suddenly there's like a faux marble finish or you know, formica, what have you.
Right.
And just this sort of cluttered, ugly look of styles being stacked on top of each other. And that's what it kind of comes across to me as far as like a unified look or vision, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
That it's just stultified and just not together. And so, I mean, but that's mainly just a comment on what you're saying about Picasso and covering it up, but convincingly.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the exercise he was referring to is that you take a blank piece of paper, and I think almost anybody, if you just put a couple of strokes of something on there, it can be very, very interesting.
Uh-huh.
In fact, a lot of times I do things where I'll go, oh, I just love it. But there's not enough there. I couldn't take it to the marketplace. I couldn't present it to somebody.
Not in good conscience, anyway.
No, I just couldn't do it.
Because granted, there's a lot that you could get away with. I mean,
well, I think so. At this point, yeah, when you're recognized, it's kind of like once you're famous enough to just scribble on a table napkin and somebody wants to pay for it.
Well, there was the SNL sketch with Picasso where John Lovitz was playing Picasso and he was sitting at this cafe and he goes, take your kid to college, and he just scribbles on a napkin and just gives it to him and tells him to go off. You know.
Exactly. Oh, to be that famous. But now, abstract work, I think, is particularly challenging because there's that sense that I could do that. You know.
Or if I don't have any ideas, well, I could at least make a... At least I can create some sort of... I've got some amorphous, distracting mess of things.
Yeah.
And through that, maybe that's what it is that people see their own emotions or their own thoughts as being jumbled, and people have a lot of trouble in their daily lives, the thoughts just crashing into
one
another.
Sure.
And so even if you saw the most messy of paintings, you can relate to it because, you know, you probably felt that way at some point that day.
Right.
And so maybe that's why it gets away with it. But at the same time, you're really just relying on randoma, which is the term I have. Is randoma is when you just, of course, and this all dates to being a bullshit.
I love that randoma.
Yeah, randoma. It dates back to a lot of things where you put an A at the end of it. It was something that, you know, like a lot of style, in terms of determining like a rather different style than just electronica.
It's okay, like, well, sure.
For example. And it's like, no, that you're not really quite explaining that. That's what rock and roll magazines came up with to explain electronic music in the
19th. Okay.
And so they called it electronica because they didn't know how to review it. They didn't know what it was. They were too busy reviewing Nirvana albums. That's when becoming a bullshit artist comes in. So say, for instance, red table with the recording equipment right here. Well, see, the roundness of the table is supposed to represent the amount of trouble that's going on in the world. The technology on top of it is supposed to bring it back to Earth and to show the modernity of humankind.
I love
and
this.
So, but it's also supposed to represent the Mars and just about how much we distance ourselves from who we really are.
Ooh.
Bullshit.
Oh, that was bravo.
Yeah, bravo.
Bravo.
Good for me. $2,000.
I love it.
You can have it all.
But it's true. It's absolutely true. I think that's one of the things that I have difficulty with in the art world in general is that there is so much art speak. And so much of the, it's fraught with emotion. It's fraught with possibility. Did you ever read Tom Robbins' Skinny Legs and All?
No, I haven't. Oh. Fill me in.
Well, there's a guy and a girl. She's an artist, and he's just in love with her, and he'll do anything to please her. And so at some point, he decides to make a Airstream travel trailer into a turkey. And he makes these giant drumsticks and covers it all in foil. And this is just sort of a joke for him. But all of a sudden, he becomes this famous artist for doing this. And it's just how this affects their relationship and so forth. But one of the particularly funny things in the book is just the whole approach to the world and how they view what's really valuable art and what's really viable as art. And is it art? And... oh, my God, it's just so amazing. And, of course, he's standing around going... You must be kidding. And the girlfriend who's been struggling to try and be an artist is going, you must be kidding.
Yeah, I mean, that must be one of the most torturous things. That's when you're a real phony. Or at least, you know, it might not be your fault, but that's when it comes down for you not being responsible for your own work, is when you're being all the hullabaloo about you, but you don't even believe in what you're making.
Exactly, exactly. There's just, you know, art history... having not been professionally trained, I didn't go to school, I've done a lot of reading, I guess you could call me self-educated, but I think that there's certain people who make art because they want the attention, and there's certain people who make art because they're trying to record some sort of history, if you will. Certainly early art did that. I think most people who make art are somehow compelled to do it, and it's not, since it's not usually considered, you know, a big money maker.
I'm kind of both, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, yes, I'm starved for the recognition, but at the same time, it's because, you know, I want to, you know, communicate something and create something. I want to be responsible for it. So I guess you have to be compelled.
There's something, that unknown has to compel you.
Yeah, that's why I always wonder about people that were investment bankers and at the age of 40 decided, oh, well, you know, I want to get into this art thing. I mean, somebody who has made their, you know, their $1 million and they're suddenly interested in doing it. And I always have trouble with the sincerity of that. It's like, well, God, how did you get all the way to
that transition?
How did you get all the way to 40 without already having given into this? I mean, because for so many of the artists that I meet, especially self-taught ones, I mean, these are people that couldn't help themselves. Whether or not they had the money to go to college for it, or whether or not they had precedents to follow.
Something just made them say, I got to make something here.
Yeah, and you know, like for some reason, I was looking up Shel Silverstein because I was listening to his songs, and I grew up on him, and he was just such a big deal for me when I was a little kid. You know, every week when I would go to the library, you get to check out 2 books, and I would just...
God, I remember those days.
Yeah, me too. And I would, I would just basically put Where the Sidewalk Ends and then order it back out. And so I just kept Where the Sidewalk Ends for, like, the whole first grade.
Wow.
And, when I looked up him and the fact of what the interviews, he did few interviews, but he was somebody who didn't have precedent. He's somebody who really didn't have anybody to, you know, to borrow from.
Uh-huh.
And which is why he ended up being so damn original in just about every way. And somebody who is very shied away from fame very much, but when you see people like that and who cannot, if you, and this is an argument I've made in many cases, if you don't have anything to, I mean, I had my artist and I know you've had yours. When you don't have, you know, that formal education, mm-hmm. in terms of it, you cannot quite help but be original if you have vision, if you're able to.
Well, that's, I was just thinking that in a way, it's somewhat, to me, it's been advantageous to not have that education because I couldn't call upon a lot of things I'd already seen. It wasn't like I wasn't going to be that influenced by other stuff I'd seen because I hadn't seen it. There were people that it was real evident I had seen pictures of their work, like Mark Rothko, when I first started painting.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Rothko.
Oh my God, at my first opening, I had some guy who was another artist in the same gallery, and he, you know, the jealousy, the little green-eyed monster was out, and he said to me, "Well, somebody told me that you've never even heard of Mark Rothko." And I was, this was 18 or 20 years ago, and I looked at him with these big eyes, and I went, "Oh no, I love Mark Rothko. He's one of my heroes." And the guy then said, "So why do you think he killed himself?" And I know he was trying to trick me. You know, he was trying to screw with me.
Wait, so he wasn't asking for any specific answer?
No, this was to just yank my chain. And fortunately, sometimes being naive is to your benefit. I simply went, "Oh my God, there's no way you can ever explain why someone commits suicide." And I smiled and walked away. But it was one of those things where, in, you know, my career spans about 20 years now, and I certainly would say there's been situations where people have tried to not make fun of me, but pointed out, you know, you're an amateur, or you didn't go to school, or you started this.
To put you in your place.
Put me in my place. Very good. And there's been times, definitely, when I took it to heart, but for the most part, I guess I'm lucky that my take on life is such that I just went, okay, you don't like it, but that's all right. I like it, and there's other people who like it. I don't do this to please everybody, because, mm-hmm. you know, there's that famous, if you try to please everybody, you won't please anybody.
Yeah.
Well,
I always say, you know what they always say, you can't please anybody.
No.
And for the record, Mark Rothko killed himself because he was really depressed.
Exactly. Yeah. The poor man was very, very sick.
But that doesn't... It was Tom York of Radiohead was being interviewed, and it was about... I forget what the subject was exactly. It was around the time that Kid A had come out,
uh-huh.
and he was talking about the fact that Rothko had killed himself. I think he was talking about how their work is being viewed by others, and he was... talking about how when children would go and see a bunch of Rothko pieces, that they would just be immediately just amazed and you know, just at the beauty of the colors and how beautiful his work was. And it is. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And the adults, though, were so busy talking about the fact that he had killed himself.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, but ultimately, it doesn't really matter so much. I mean, you know, just the look at all these children going around and seeing Rothko pieces and looking at the beautiful colors.
Right.
But, of course, he was a much deeper man than that. But, of course, as you were referring to earlier, is the children responding and having that sense of innocence, which,
oh, yeah.
You know, of course, I'm kind of cynical when it comes to innocence.
Well, and that's a whole other iteration.
Yeah,
that's a whole other conversation.
But, I mean... What other, you had your influences. I had my influences as in Bruegel or Goya or Bosch or
mm-hmm.
Giger, certain people in my life that I was obviously affected by. Before I was really, I mean, I was always a hand drawing artist because back when I was like 11, 12, 13,
uh-huh.
all you could really do is just steal reams of copy paper and draw on them.
Right.
You know, we didn't
right.
have canvases and
no.
the materials.
Oh my God, all those supplies.
Oh, and I suck at painting, by the way, Susan.
Well, some people, my mom, tremendous draftsman, can draw, can do anything that where the tool is right there in her hand, like a charcoal or a pastel.
Mm-hmm.
Give her a paintbrush and she kind of goes a different way. With the talent isn't as strong as it is.
Are you saying she misuses the tools?
No, she's brilliant with pen or pencil or charcoal, but somehow a paintbrush, she can't translate it as well.
Yeah, it was just always really sloppy for me.
To me, it's like, well, don't worry. If your strong suit is drawing, then draw.
Yeah. Are you good at drawing?
No, and I don't have any desire to. I can look at a magnificent drawing and marvel over it. Actually, when you really think about it, some of the most talented people on the planet are illustrators.
Yeah.
Talk about talent.
Yeah, anything from graphic novels to so on and so
medical,
forth.
Medical plants, you know, textbook, everything.
Yeah, you see all those classic etchings of anatomy or, you know, the
these are talented
historical
people.
Or when, you know, when Bruegel, I think it was Bruegel that did like the circles of hell and just all of these gorgeous.
Oh, yes. I mean, detailed and everything from any angle, it doesn't matter. No, I don't draw, and it's not anything that I've ever been compelled to do. I took, you know, in high school, we had to take like a semester of art. And they'd set up a still life, and they'd make you sit, and they'd make you draw this thing, and you had to do a sketchbook every semester, and there was nothing. All I wanted to do was clean the paintbrushes. I was like, okay, I'll clean all the paintbrushes up. And
what, were you trying to give them a hint?
No, at the time, this was nothing I envisioned was my direction. I didn't start painting until I was in my mid-30s.
Well, what was your direction until then? Investment broker?
Yeah, I think I was...
Attorney?
No, not... That would be... I'm okay numbers, but that would just bore me to tears.
Oh, yeah. What was it?
I wanted to be a fashion model.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. I was just convinced I could be a fashion model.
It's not too late.
Well, I'm just too short.
Yeah. Was that the problem? You weren't a healthy 5'10"?
Well, I wasn't.
Or was it 5'9"? I don't remember.
Listen, I'd settle for 5'5". No, I really thought I could do that as a kid. And then it was like, well, all right, I'm not any place where I'm going to be a fashion model, but I can make clothes, so then I'm going to be a fashion designer. And so all through high school, I made clothes. I mean, I made suits and prom gowns and coats and bathing suits, and I thought, oh, I'll be a fashion designer. And then, you know, real life sets in, and you get to be in your early 20s, and you get married, and you go, okay, well, I guess I'll be a married person now, and then, okay, well, I'm still working. So my work life always centered around business, really. I mean, I worked in all kinds of business environments. I worked in politics and government. I worked in... I worked for a governor for 2.5 years in Connecticut. I worked in the state capitol for 5 years in nonpartisan stuff. So, I mean, I've done that. I've done, I've been real estate sales. I've worked for real estate developers. So I think I thought I saw myself as a business person, but probably like a really good Girl Friday, not to be sexist or, you know, use the old-fashioned term.
Uh-huh.
But I really thought I would become a like a helpmate to somebody. First of all, you know, imagine being the traditional wife, the helpmate to the husband, and then in the workplace to be a helpmate to some really genius guy, usually. And I work for a lot of really, really bright people. And I loved it. I mean, I loved the excitement of their minds. You know, they could, I'm really good at understanding things when someone explains them to me, but I can't think them up that well. So if somebody's telling me about a great way to do a deal in real estate, I can sit there with my mouth open going, wow, wow, oh, that makes perfect sense. But how did you ever think it up? And so I was really good with running with the ball. They'd come up with the idea, and then I could run with the ball and do all the dirty work and the leg work and the follow-through.
Do you think this was a common expectation that was created for young women at the time? I mean, this was sort of a thing that you were going to be, that you needed a man in your life, or you needed to be just the caring nurturer to
absolutely.
The independent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And but, of course, once you got into the art world, I mean, I think you're doing pretty damn well here. In terms of how, say, for instance, the gobbledygook or the conceptualizing of real estate
mm-hmm.
or politics, you have the ability to really formulate your craft and what you
mm-hmm.
do now that you're a painter, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that you'd better understand at this point.
Well, every job I had, every sort of work environment that I was in, and I was in some different things. The fundamental thing that always served me was that I was curious and I was a pleaser, which in therapy they go, oh God, there's your problem. You're a pleaser. You know, you're going to just bend over backwards to make everybody else happy and you'll be miserable. But in the long run, it was like, well, once I learned to temper that pleasing angle, the rest of it was just that no matter what I was doing, I wanted to do the best it could. Not the best I could do it, the best it could be done. And that always served me well because I worked hard, I produced well, whatever it was. I don't care if it was writing letters. I mean, you like to write, it's a gift to be able to sit down and go, okay, you need to say this, and you just can spit it out. So I took the talents that I had developed by then, and I'm in my late 50s now, so it was a long time ago doing a lot of things, but I always still had a real strong work ethic and a sense of responsibility that I had to do it well, and I had to carry my end of the job. I was always a partner to me. It was always whatever I was contributing was part of the deal.
But although that sounds very formal, I mean, it sounds as
though,
in the business
world,
lettering and such. I mean, does that reflect in your work?
I think it does because ultimately, it gave me the work discipline to get up and go every single day in the art world when, you know, a lot of artists will feel like, well, I don't feel creative today, I don't have to, you know, I don't have a boss who's saying, you know, where's Susan? You know, she's supposed to be here.
Mr. B. He's going to be real pissed at you.
Mr. B. When I first left the business world and started painting full time, it took several years before I stopped thinking the phone was going to ring and someone was going to be looking for me because I hadn't, you know, somebody needed me. Roger's looking for you. Where are you? Because I transitioned over a period of years out of the business world and into painting.
And to have to deal with your own expectations as opposed to somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you know, and I can say, you know, a lot of your work doesn't have really any typos in it. I don't have to get my red pen out.
You don't. No corrections necessary. But ultimately, I think what it gave me was a good sense of business and a good sense of good product. Like, I'm real conscientious about what the quality of my product is. It's the canvases are well stretched. The paint is quite high quality. I like it to just be a really beautiful finished thing. And I think for some artists, their concern is only like what's on the front of it, you know. Which is not. I can't say there's something wrong with that. It's just that my way of looking at it is that the whole 3D thing has to be real quality. Especially when you start charging for it. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, the whole damn thing had better be right.
The sticks in the back and the canvas in the back. I don't want it to be a sloppy, yucky, limp, you know, canvases you pick up with that one stretcher bar in the back. It's like, I've seen stuff in galleries, the back of them, you just think, how do you hang that? How do you keep it even from folding on itself? There's no support back there.
And if you have any respect for the work that you've made, why would you treat it in such a way?
I guess that's what I mean. It's just that the components were all applicable no matter what I was doing. Even, you know, I mean, if you're housekeeping, if you're gardening, there's a level of quality you want to put into your effort. And so that's, I believe I gleaned a lot of that from the business world. And then from a standpoint of promoting yourself or communicating with people, you know, when I was starting out, people weren't knocking on my door. I had to go out there into the workplace or into the marketplace and try and find people that were interested in the art. And I did everything from backdrops for photographers. When I moved to Santa Fe from Los Angeles, I didn't know anybody. I was, at that time, painting textiles. I was painting fabrics and making them into pillows. That's really how I started. It was my entire initiation.
Making
was,
pillows out of fabrics?
Well, I would paint canvas and then sew it into a pillow.
Oh, wow.
And I did that while I had this full-time office job. And when I look back now, I don't know where I found the energy. I would get up in the morning, go to the gym, go to the office, work 10 hours at the office, get home, and look at the clock and go, oh, wow, it's 9 o'clock. I can paint for 3 hours. So I just was painting these. I did it as a gift for somebody, and then I thought I liked it. And then I started saying, well, maybe I could peddle these at some of these local boutiques. So I would make up inventory. Well, the real fun part was I would go into these little interior design boutiques. And here's where all the artists are going to go, aha, she's just an interior design slut, but that's all right. I would go into these little boutiques with a handful of paint chips, and I would go around and match my paint chips to certain like pottery or rugs in these little boutiques, and then I would go home and I would paint pillows to match all their stuff, and then make an appointment to come in
and say,
and
hey,
say, would you be interested
this
in,
would fit in
showing these
next to
on
your
consignment
pottery.
Yes, and so there it was. It was like instant merchandising, you know. It was like, oh my god, that goes perfectly with our display here. So, and at that time, I didn't see myself as becoming a fine art painter. I just liked doing this. I liked the touch of the canvas. I liked the smell of it. I liked the paint. At that time, I worked with acrylics. It was a time filler. I was compelled to do it, so I did. Well, what happened out of painting the textiles was people would see these pillows and say, well, couldn't you frame that? Couldn't you paint me something that we could frame? And so one thing led to another. And I did everything in the early days from table runners to wall coverings to upholstery fabrics. I sold some designs to some manufacturers, and they did a bedding line. That was my design. It was just like any opportunity. So when I moved to Santa Fe, what I did was I did a postcard mailer to all the photographers in town. I just took out the yellow pages. This was I don't think we had answering machines back then.
Oh, I don't even know. You didn't have beepers.
Let alone a text message or an email. I did a postcard mailer to all the photographers saying, you know, I can paint you backdrops and I have some backdrops you can rent. And then I went around and made appointments with interior designers and showed them a portfolio of things that I had done. And, you know, if you have a need. Well, it wasn't working out. I mean, Santa Fe didn't have a huge market for either photographers or interior designers, really. And I don't know if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's new book.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's brilliant. Outliers.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it on tape. He reads it, and it is so worth listening to him read it. But it's the story of how success is very, very often affected by so many factors that we don't give credence to. Like somebody you knew that knew somebody that knew somebody and they told somebody. Or like Bill Gates, for example, I didn't know this. He had access to a computer system as a teenager back in the days when even major corporations didn't have computers. And this all came about because his mom happened to be involved with a school that happened to have a computer, and he happened to be able to go in and use it after hours. So he and a couple of his buddies had the opportunity to do things that other people didn't have. Gladwell suggests that nobody can do anything until they have 10,000 hours.
I know exactly what you're... He mentioned the Beatles, too.
Yes.
In fact, of all the time that they spent in Germany, he's
that
the intellectual.
Was why they had the success.
Yes, and most people don't see that. They see it as just sort of like Meet the Beatles was them just, we're at the Cavern Club for a couple
and
of
somebody
months.
Somebody heard us. And
no, I mean, there are people that busted their asses
exactly.
to get it down.
Exactly. So I bring all this up to go back to the business connection. I don't know of too many endeavors you can do that don't require an immense amount of dedication and time. Just time actually doing it. And for me, painting, that was... Because I painted these fabrics for years before I started painting fine art, that was my practice point. And I used to number all the pillows, so I can tell you that I probably painted... 1,200 pillows, 1,000, easily over 1,000 pillows.
Well.
And, you know, so it's like, okay.
I was kind of lazy, you know. I mean, you could have at least churned out a good 2,000.
And I had a full-time job while I was doing this that had nothing to do with the painting. So, now, again, I when I look back, it's like, I don't know where it came from. I don't know why I had that energy, but I did. And then when I moved to Santa Fe, I got lucky that I met an art dealer and an artist who were both Jewish ladies, and one of them was a rabbi's wife, the artist. The art dealer wasn't. Just a nice Jewish art dealer. God bless both of them. Because of the rabbi's wife, she, in true rabbi's wife, Rebison, I think they call themselves, said, oh, you're new in town? You're an artist? Where's your phone? She called her cousin, who was a pretty established artist, and she had me meet him and then had me going to some drawing classes at his studio, really in kind of bringing me into the community. And Gladwell's book really made me stop and realize how critical that had been, because of that woman, she was the one that kept pushing that art dealer I met the same day to keep following what I was doing over the next year or two. Till one day I got the call from the dealer saying, I hear you have some new abstract work. I'll be over in an hour. Now, in the meantime, I had entered a million competitions, and I had done everything I could think of to try and produce things that had a market someplace. And again, was I being a mercenary artist? Well, I wanted to make a living making art. And if I wasn't going to, then I wanted to find out and then figure out what else I was supposed to do. But... About a year after being in Santa Fe and thinking, oh boy, by the end of that year, it was like, I think we made the wrong choice here. Things aren't working out. The textiles aren't selling. I'm probably going to have to face facts and go back to a real job. And I got that phone call from this woman, and she said, I'll be over. And she came over, and she said, well, I'll give you a try at the gallery. I can't promise you anything, but I think I like what you've got here. And this was, I had developed that surface, that smooth, shiny trademark now mm-hmm. of mine.
A mop and glow?
The mop and glow.
If I mention it on the website, I'll have to put the little restricted
Please, that's
copyright.
Right, the copyright yeah. symbol. Yeah. So, I brought some work in, and it sold right away. And then I brought some more in, and it sold, and I brought some more, and it sold until... I couldn't paint it as fast as I could sell it.
And so here you are with these lovely, lovely canvas-like pillows of yours.
Yes.
And, of course, ultimately, with as much practice and skill as involved, it's still that delicate balance, that one chance, that one opportunity.
I was in the right place at the right time. I had met the right people, or they had met me. And, yeah, there was some magic for sure, but a lot of hard work.